I know. Trust me, I've heard it.
Heard what?
Outcry from the public.
The what now?
People are mad. They're voicing their opinion, Lindsay.
Oh, you mean about, like, the unethical government that...
No, yes, but not in this case. I'm talking about the outcry, the furor over the lack of Books of Mormon's reports. All during this series we've been doing on Mountain Meadows, I just kept thinking, we'll do one for the last episode. Then we got thinking, there has been so much written about this event, stuff that is in itself historic, that we thought we would, wait for it,
do an entire Books of Mormon's report episode.
Listen, we agreed I get to say that. It's like live from New York. You stole my thunder.
Yeah. Go cry to old Jetty Grant about it. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
You know, Lindsay, speaking of books, as we frequently are wont to do, our friends at the University of Utah Press have just published a book that listeners will be interested in.
This is very true. Let's talk about it. Lori Wrinkle was 16 when she delivered her first baby. I witnessed the entire universe unfold at my feet, she writes in Desert Birthright. Later, working as a hospital doula, Wrinkle observed firsthand the suffering inflicted upon birthing women by male-dominated Western childbirth practices, from casual racism to unnecessary and non-consensual procedures, including the dreaded husband stitch. After a traumatic labor and delivery of her own, she decided to take back a woman-centered childbirth and start a home birth midwifery practice. Desert Birthright traverses 25 years of midwifery, often in fundamentalist polygamous circles, weaving together birth stories with childhood memories, as Wrinkle grapples with her shifting Mormon faith. Her poetic voice shines. A placenta becomes the tree of life, the folds in a baby's arms, layers of sand in the desert. Desert Birthright is a deeply personal story of life, death, and modern womanhood in the rural Southwest, and one midwife's journey of faith, self-discovery, and liberation in the face of adversity. I got to review this book. I thought it was lovely. I learned so much about it, actually. Some really cool stuff as far as the folklore and legend of birthing practices of old pioneer women up until today. You should definitely check it out and learn about the husband stitch. If you don't know what that is, we're not going to tell you. You'll have to read about it. Desert Birthright, A Midwife's Memoir by Lori Wrinkle, new from the University of Utah Press. And because the press are good people, use code SUNSTONE35 to get 35% off everything at their site. Visit them at uofupress.com.
I'd like to pack this in and take you to the stars. We'll eat in fancy restaurants and drop in fancy cars. We tried our luck, we made a buck, so lean back, have some fun.
Oh yes, my love. Hey Brian, how you been?
Good. Okay, it's coming to me. This is bad.
Jennifer. I'm an old
Jennifer.
Friend.
No.
Close.
Lindsay.
Yes. That's the one. There's so many of me. So many redheads in your life, you can't keep track.
It's been a minute. We know that. You people have very kindly, in email form, in person form. By the way, thanks for coming and saying hi at the store. We've heard you, and we're back. So there's been things. Let's call them the holidays.
Did you miss us?
Projects?
Did you miss us? Are you sad? It's been a long time. Listen, we did 6 episodes on the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
One more than sanity would allow for, I believe.
It wasn't good. I don't like them. I'm glad it's over. I forced Brian through too much of Frontier Utah. We needed a break. So what have you been up to? Why have we been gone? Listen, we have been consistent putting these out, but they are a ton of work. People will always be like, oh, we love the production. Who produces it? I do. I literally do that in my bed while I eat Cheez-Its and drink my many, many swig drinks. It's not good for my health. And we do it for the love of the game, but it's a lot of effing work. And we just got busy. Brian, what have you been up to?
Oh, so many fun projects, including projects that came thanks to listeners. So we have fun stuff in store for the podcast. We have fun stuff in store personally. If you don't know either of us, we really have a hard time saying no to a fun project. And so the fun projects just kind of pile up. And there's not a lot of time. We both have kids. And so moral of the story is we're back. Some might argue better than ever.
Better than ever. We've never taken a hiatus like this. It just kind of happened. We're both in busy projects. It was the holidays. I'm working on some movies. Brian's working on a bajillion different books and projects. My Juanita project is about to come out. We say that, but the University of
Utah
Press,
who
we love. It just takes a long time. Yeah, I've just been busy doing movie stuff and haven't given even Juanita the love she needed, but she's ready. She's ready to go. Now we're just waiting for the press, which should be soon. So we've got an exciting year ahead, too. Brian, do you have anything coming out this year?
Probably not quite this year, but stuff is getting close. So my two front burner projects at the moment are the Joseph Musser Diaries and Correspondence that I'm working on with friend of the podcast, Dr. Christina Galliano, and then also Mike Quinn's diaries. So got some fun stuff cooking.
You know, speaking of Christina and our friend, she's up there in Canada now living her best life. Every time she sends me pictures, it's like I'm trying to think of the novelist. There's the At Home in Mitford series. Have you heard of it? It's about like a priest living up there in a little village who solves mysteries. That's Christina. She's like a priest's wife. She has a parish. They quilt all the time. Every time she sends me pictures, it's like homemade butter she's made. And
I know it's a different part of Canada, but it also has some Anne of Green Gables mixed into it.
It is, like. But French, right? Like,
yeah, give Anne a little Quebecois accent and you're about there. So
I know she's a good scholar and I know she's semi-retired from Mormonism. She wouldn't like that I said semi. She says she's fully retired, but your update would prove otherwise.
Oh, yeah. She feels retired. And then she's like, oh, yeah, we need to finish our book, huh?
She can't quit us. Well, I'm excited for that. And you'll be hearing ad nauseum about Juanita soon once the press has had its way with her. They're designing the cover right now, which is really exciting. And yeah, and movies I'm sure you'll hear more about as they come out. But let's get into it. We're back to Mountain Meadows Massacre, but we're done talking about the massacre for GD once. And now we're going to talk about
books about the massacre. So listen, people. You're about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
No, just no.
All right, fine. That was probably a little much.
As we talked about, the Mountain Meadows Massacre is one of the most critical and horrific events in Mormon history. Not surprisingly, it has been a common topic for people to write about, to understand, to contextualize, sometimes to sweep under the rug. The behind the scenes of who was writing about it, why they were writing about it, how they were writing about it is also important. It also tells us a lot about Mormon history itself.
The massacre itself is barely over before it becomes a topic for ink on paper. One of the first and very influential pieces that addressed the massacre was a speech from non-Mormon judge John Cradlebaugh. Cradlebaugh comes from Ohio, and at first, when he gets out here, he's welcomed by the Mormons. Eve Hanks noted of him, quote, "The judge possessed but one eye, and that is a very good one."
See, that's the judge I'm always trying to remember who the Brigham Young would make fun of his eye. It was Cradlebaugh.
I chuckled at that. That was pretty entertaining. So Cradlebaugh, at first, tried to play nice. He was telling Mormons all of the things they wanted to hear. Other federal appointees were prejudiced against them. That kind of thing. Brigham enjoyed that.
However, Cradle Boss soon started to hear disturbing tales. Locals, some of whom were on the fringes of Mormon society, slowly clue the judge in that the massacre wasn't done by Native Americans. On the contrary, it was Mormon-driven from the beginning. Who knew? After some quiet sleuthing, Cradlebaugh and his one good eye convenes a grand jury to try and prosecute the massacre. Brian, you're going to need to sit down because I have some shocking news.
Okay, I'm ready.
It didn't go smoothly.
What?
You've got Mormon attorneys and court officials and a non-Mormon judge appointed from back east. Where have we heard this story before?
Things were a little different this time, though, because Johnny C. was not about to pull a W.W. Drummond. Homie, don't play that. He discussed several murders in addition to Mountain Meadows, noted how having LDS leaders as probate judges handling decidedly non-probate things was not great, and how, quote, no person can commit crimes and say they are authorized by higher authorities, and if they have any such notions, they will have to dispel them. It was a tense room. I think we can all agree on that.
Poor little Hosea Stout was not enjoying having to sit there and listen to this. He whined, and I remember Hosea Stout was judge advocate at the time. Was he judge advocate at this time? He was an attorney.
He thought he was the judge over everything.
He held the judge over everything key. I mean, he go back to our episodes about him, but basically he's there to defend the Mormons.
And squirrel in chief? Was that his official position?
Man, that guy. Did I tell you that I wrote a feature about him just recently? Yeah, very murdery. Okay, so he whined that the judge referred to everything that had happened or been falsely reported to the district for the last 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure what Squirrel's brother Stout had been talking to or strangling, but what about that was false? These things all happened, and he wasn't alone. The people of Provo got up a petition arguing that having the military there to oversee the proceedings was a direct infringement upon the rights of American citizens and a gross violation of our liberties. Geez, nothing changes in Utah. I think there were about 120 people buried nearby who would like to call scoreboard here, Hosea Stout. Trying to argue that a process to bring the perpetrators of Mountain Meadows to justice was some travesty of civil rights is a little much, but very much in Hosea Stout's, what's the word I want?
Wheelhouse.
Wheelhouse. Sure, we'll go with that.
That's his MO. And seeing the handwriting on the wall, Cradlebaugh chastised this grand jury for failing to do their duty and then kicked him out. And then, a few years later, he would give a speech in the U.S. House of Representatives. So he discusses his perspective on Mormon society. Spoiler alert, by that point, he was not a fan. And then, more to the point for our discussion today, discussed the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And the judge had some pretty explicit questions. Why was it that Brigham did not report this massacre at the Mountain Meadows? Why, if he was acting as superintendent of Indian Affairs, did he not make report of the property taken at the massacre? And let me ask my conjugal friend, the delegate from Utah, why it was that the Deseret News, the church organ and only paper published in the territory, for months after failed to notice the massacre, even after it was well known in the states. And when it did so, only did it to say, the Mormons were not engaged in it. Good questions, Judge.
Questions, great questions, questions we all want to know. While his experiences happened first, it would be published later. However, Cradlebaugh sort of tagged someone else into the ring at the same time, Brevet Major James Carlton, as featured in Under the Banner of Heaven for about 3 seconds. While Carlton's explicit mission was to finally bury the bones at the massacre site, he also investigated some and came to the same conclusion as Cradlebaugh. Mormons were responsible. His report, published in 1860, so before Cradlebaugh's speech, was another extremely important source. And we didn't talk about this on our last one, but basically when the government sends someone, they send Major Carlton in to go investigate the site. And he does. He's one of the first official investigators on the site. And of course, both have problems, but let's be honest, it's not like people were super pumped to tell them details. It's not like a cover-up hadn't ensued. And of course, he comes in after the massacre had been there, like, it was 59, so it's like almost 2 years later. And that's about it for a while. Mormons, of course, were not about to say anything. They were too concerned about their civil rights to protect the justice of 120 people massacred.
Touch me if you want to. I got both.
The nation wanted to have something done, sure, but polygamy is already starting to suck all the oxygen up in the room. John Dealey's trial and execution a little bit later served as a partial solution, but the Mountain Meadows massacre really remains a festering sore, as Will Bagley described it. Then, in the 1880s, Deseret News editor and future apostle and First Presidency counselor Charles Penrose complained that missionaries are constantly being confronted with a massacre. So in 1884, he gives a talk on the massacre that's also published as a pamphlet. He also published a thing about blood atonement, which I'm sure was a coincidence.
Bagley identifies Penrose's discourse as just part of a, quote, large and coordinated public relations effort to search the church's vast records for evidence that would provide a credible defense of Brigham Young. At the same time, non-Mormon historian H.H. Bancroft is working on a massive multi-volume history of the West, and Mormon leaders are oh so excited to give him the white glove treatment so that the coverage of the Mormons are favorable. They throw assistant church historian and apostle Franklin D. Richards and the staff of the historian's office at him. While Bancroft ultimately didn't just let them write all over him, he didn't quite get at the whole story, concluding that, quote, this horrible crime so persistently charged upon the Mormon Church and its leaders was a crime of an individual, the crime of a fanatic of the worst stamp. Wow, we really messed that up. You can already hear the John Dealey descendants sharpening their vintage knives in the background.
And a few years later, Andrew Jensen, a Mormon, a guy who wanted to be a church historian so bad they finally just gave in and let him, went on an important tour of southern Utah to interview people who are still around. Now, you're going to stick a pin in this story with the initials JB on it for a few minutes from now. Those documents he produced are going to be a little hard to find later. How long can this journey go on? Will I find the place I'm meant to go? Will dreams fall down around us, just like the winter snow? Another year has come and gone. Will my luck hold for 1 year more? I think of how far that I've come and what's been left behind.
Our next stop is B.H. Roberts. When he revises a history, he had serialized in a magazine for the official six-volume comprehensive history of the church, published for the centennial year of 1930. He actually does have something to say about the massacre. However, Will Bagley argues that his better qualities failed him on this one. He basically just takes the Bancroft narrative from 40 years earlier and runs with that.
Are you kidding me? These nice people have been listening patiently, and you're telling them that not even Saint B.H. is going to help them out?
Sorry, friends.
So in other words, if I'm getting this right, B.H. stands for Big Help in the sarcastic sense?
I guess.
I don't think his mom should even have gotten to marry John W. Woolley.
Nice try. Don't even think about taking us on the fundamentalist tangent tonight.
Well, can we at least talk about the two Josiahs?
Fine.
All right, first up, Josiah Gibbs. He's born in Nauvoo. After coming to Utah as a kid, he later said he was confronted with shadows of the massacre growing up. From talking to one of the children who are spared to hearing about the event while he's working on a ranch, he feels like he just couldn't get away from it. I'll spare you all the rabbit holes I went down. I will thank artists for a post on Keepa. Suffice it to say that Gibbs in later life takes a bit of a Frank J. Cannon path. After the turn of the century, he gets real disenchanted with his Mormonism.
Can I just ask if the P was involved somehow?
Yeah, definitely. That's always a good guess. There were a lot of things that bugged him, but it sounds like the P might have been the biggest of them all. And as the Smoot hearings heated up after the turn of the century, Gibbs turns up his heat on Joseph F. Smith. He's actually excommunicated in 1908, and then he publishes a small monograph on the massacre in 1910. Now, given everything I just told you, honestly, his work on the massacre is pretty balanced. For the time, I would say his work is pretty state of the art.
Sounds like we need a more orthodox Josiah.
Sort of.
In the wake of Gibbs's pamphlet on the massacre, it seems like a response was needed to that. And so our next Josiah is more murky. In 1911, with no explanation, Josiah Rogerson shows up with a manuscript on the massacre that is being read by general authorities. Will Bagley describes this episode as being an official response, but it might be a little more complicated. Rogerson had written a pretty extensive manuscript, and it's not clear what exactly happened. He was in an interesting spot. He had taken down the first John D. Lee trial in shorthand in 1877, so he clearly knew more about this episode than most. There is a whole ass story about this, but we won't bore you with it now.
Without the help of speedy delivery, Mr. Rogerson apparently created something he would later call a little book. And here's where the mystery is. There is a collection at the Church History Library that has some random chunks of things, but there's nothing there that is anywhere in the same zip code as a book draft. He seems to have read some parts of something to a few of the apostles, and then...
poof. They had paid him some money, but then out of the blue told him that the manuscript wasn't going to be published, and apparently asked for the manuscript and the publication rights. But Rogerson wasn't having it. He said he would retain the publishing rights because he felt like there was a demand. Psst, you know what? He was probably right. After all of that happened, people were wanting to know what had happened. So he asked for more money. Sounds like he got shot down, and that was that. Shot down is not a good metaphor, though.
That's a real bad metaphor. That's a good point. So why did his project just go poof? Why did they apparently ask him to do this, and then in the end tell him to go play in traffic? Why aren't we talking about a published book from Rogerson? Couple thoughts, all of which are very admittedly hypotheticals here. So first, perhaps the best reason this is a hypothetical discussion is we're not really sure what Rogerson had. Bagley wondered if there was another manuscript that looked more like a book, which is definitely a possibility. Second, it seems that Rogers had a thing for not finishing projects. He had also started a book about the handcart disaster. This is a guy ahead of his time. That never materialized. So it's also possible that this quote-unquote book met the same fate, and we actually do have everything that he produced. And then finally, from the church standpoint, it may just be that they decided that they just didn't really want to talk about the massacre after all. There's no good way to put the lipstick on the pig here. There just isn't. Very likely, they admitted that internally, quietly, and cut bait. And that's it. No one ever wrote anything about the Mountain Meadows Massacre again. This was enough.
Excuse me, are you going to pretend like Juanita doesn't exist and hasn't been already brought up in this conversation?
Oh, right, Juanita. And that, remind me, that's W-A-N-E-T-A, Juanita?
Occasionally, but that's beside the book and you're going to have to, that's beside the point and you're going to have to read the book for that. Yeah, so just a quick testimonial for Juanita and her book project. She, of course, is most famous for bringing the massacre to light. We talked about these other things that had been happening, but Juanita, of course, growing up in the literal shadow of this, she grows up in southern Utah. Her grandfather, Dudley Lovett, was one of the leaders that was involved in orchestrating the massacre. She knows these guys and she hears their stories and she hears whisperings and sometimes things don't add up. And, in the biography, I write what those things are, including sitting at the hearth of her grandfather when he starts speaking in Paiute and saying songs, and Nephi Johnson, who was haunted on his deathbed, crying blood, 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 telling Juanita that he has to tell her that, you know, confess to her before he dies, all of that kind of stuff. So Juanita gets interested and she does a really comprehensive, the first really big comprehensive, there were other people that had, like we had mentioned, there were other people that had messed around with manuscripts and tried ideas and thought that they were going to tell the story, but really Juanita is the one that organizes it all.
So let's talk about her project. Given the enormity of the massacre, writing about it, researching, dealing with it, it's not surprising that the first major milepost of Juanita Brooks' involvement with the massacre carries some hallmarks of mythos. So, she is a school teacher, she's 21 years old. This old man in the community named Nephi Johnson approaches her and says he wants her to do some writing for him. She's not exactly sure what to do about this, so she just kind of puts him off. But then, a few months later, he's now dying. She's summoned to his bedside. Now she's ready to do some writing, but it's too late. He dies, groaning, blood, blood, blood. That. Right there, that's what I mean by mythos. She paints this picture later as part of her ongoing memoir project. This experience is definitely memorable, but that's really about all it does for her at this point.
As Juanita dove into her work with the WPA, which we talk about in the book, the Public Works Project that the government instills to help people during the Great Depression in the 1930s, the massacre began to reappear in her life. As she relentlessly pursues pioneer journals and records, the blood of the past returned. And often it would just be a throwaway line in a document, but she noticed that the stories didn't always line up, the stories that she had heard growing up, and they were always shrouded by this weird secrecy. And kind of a shame. And this was a shared wound, one that had never been allowed to heal, hidden under layers of trauma, layers of shame. She slowly came to realize that it would continue to fester until someone was brave enough to confront it.
That someone was her, the little school teacher, and she knew it. Her growing friendship with important people like Dale Morgan is invaluable. And as she starts staking her claim on telling the story, people start coming out of the woodwork and they have key pieces to this puzzle, pieces that have never been seen by anyone outside of these families. And Juanita, perhaps her most notable character trait, she never stopped digging. She would hear about a family that had a key journal, even if it was only kind of tangentially related, and she would do whatever was necessary to get it. Riding the night bus, using her best sales techniques, assuring people that she wanted to honor her heritage, their heritage. She convinced people to lend their family, their precious family treasures to her until she could either copy them or transcribe them and then give them back. Slowly, gradually, inexorably, she amasses a stockpile of sources. Now, she had to figure out how to weave them all together.
And this was a very tricky process. She had made friends with people like Eddie Lee, who wanted to see their ancestors, their own grandfather, John D. Lee, rehabilitated. And that was where she had her biggest struggle, because Lee wasn't innocent. He was nuts. He murdered people. And yes, he wasn't the only one, and he was scapegoated, but he wasn't a good guy. I mean, we've talked about him in Nauvoo. Look, see what he was doing in Missouri. Not a good guy. And he certainly shouldn't have been the only one brought to justice. That was an injustice, and it did impact the family. But he was still a killer, and the line between contextualizing and being too sympathetic to historical figures is very, very difficult to walk. But she was up for the task.
Over the course of more than a decade, Juanita slowly chips away at the story. And it's very interesting because we can see her evolving during this process. Initially, she starts believing the old story that it was largely Native participants with maybe a few white men at the massacre. And that was tough. That was a narrative that was hard to reorient. This had been going on for decades. It also didn't help that she's trying to write serious, challenging Mormon history at a precise time that it was not welcome, particularly as a woman. Her friend, Ish, Fawn Brody, would be excommunicated in 1946, something that definitely did not go unnoticed by Juanita. She didn't want to have to confront the church that she loved, but she also wanted to tell the story candidly and completely. So to talk about one of these episodes, it's time to pull out a pin. Remember that very sharp, very intricately designed pin with JB on it that you stuck a few minutes ago?
We're back to nerdy old Andrew Jensen tramping down the dusty roads of southern Utah. It's hard to know when exactly she learned about them. It seems that Dale Morgan stumbled across a mention in Jensen's autobiography, but Juanita discovered that they were squirreled away in the LDS Church's hands.
Squirrels? Don't tell Hosea Stout.
Not that kind of squirrel. You know what? It's not important. There were also the affidavits collected by David Morris after Jensen's tour, and unfortunately, they were also in the same squirrel prison. Juanita had followed them from David Morris, who initially said she could see them, but then they went radio silence until they ended up directly in David O. McKay's hands. And McKay's secretary gave her the runaround, saying that she had never seen them and basically told Juanita to go play in traffic. So Juanita did what she usually did. She boldly went for it. She wrote to Church President George Albert Smith, who was very friendly in his reply, but then admitted he had no idea what she was talking about and punted her to his counselor, David O. McKay. She did her best, but could only make it as far as the first presidency secretary, Joseph Anderson, who was not interested in showing people anything. Later, he would stonewall Leonard Arrington for seeing the Council of 50 Minutes, telling him that Heber J. Grant had given him strict instructions a zillion years ago to not let anyone see them. Anderson wasn't a guy who budged, so this was one of the very few occasions where Juanita couldn't prevail.
No matter. When these documents were finally released decades later, more on that later, it turned out they really wouldn't have made a big impact on her research, and because of her relentless quest for sources and documents, Juanita was more than able to collect the goods. Thanks to some help from her friend Wallace Stegner, Juanita finally landed with Stanford University Press. By this point, there's a real concern that she might face church discipline. Again, remember, we're only 5 years away from No Man Knows My History. Ultimately, Juanita didn't care. She felt like her church, which she truly believed in, deserved nothing less than the truth. The whole truth, so help her God.
The book was released to nearly universal praise. It really was quite the accomplishment for a non-trained historian to step in and write a landmark exploration of this incredibly controversial topic. The book remains in print until today, a testament to its value. It would remain the standard book of the massacre for decades, and it had no peer. That is, until a very vintage touch, an old-fashioned help wanted ad in the paper.
Stand tall for the beast of America. Lay down like a naked dead body. Keep it real for the...
In 1995, Salt Lake resident and self-taught historian Will Bagley read an ad in the Salt Lake Tribune requesting help on a 2-year project to research the Fancher wagon train, the train that gets massacred. Fittingly enough, the ad said that the wagon train came west in 1859. Of course, that is 2 years after it actually did. So even in 1995, the massacre is still cloudy in the minds of many. Bagley submits his resume and is selected out of dozens of applicants. The project's backer was a rich businessman who had converted to Mormonism and felt this horrific episode still needed more daylight.
During the long slog, Bagley was very clear that he saw his role not as pushing back on Juanita Brooks's work, but to kick the can further down the road. He knew the truth every historian knows. It's always easier to be the second person at the scene. After rereading Brooks's study, he identified other possible avenues of research and sources that were either unavailable or unknown to Juanita at the time. And then the unthinkable happened. Well, actually, it would usually be unthinkable, but when discussing the massacre, nothing is off the table. Bagley's financial backer was at the end of his road. His wife divorced him, his finances were a smoking ruin, and the feds were on his tail. His final act?
Great question. We have no idea. He just disappeared. Truly. His secretary thought he was murdered, and this kind of leaves Will in a weird place. His backer originally thought of making a movie or maybe a novel, but Will decided to turn all of this hard work into a straightforward history, a book very much like Juanita's 50 years earlier.
Will noted that by 1997, I believe the massacre was exactly what Brigham Young said it was in 1861, an act of righteous vengeance. He was very clear about what he was doing in Blood of the Prophets. He declared right at the beginning, quote, "This book answers what may be the most frequently asked question about Mountain Meadows. What did Brigham Young know and when did he know it?" And if we were to summarize Will's final position on this, it would be that there was not enough evidence that Young directly ordered the massacre, but was certainly an accessory after the fact, at least. And he was fond of quoting from an 18th century trial, quote, "The suppressing of evidence ought always to be taken for the strongest evidence."
There's a couple places where Will got a little too handsy with some of his theories. He was always locked in on the element of Eleanor McLean arriving in this dramatic scene on July 24th. Remember, we talked about this earlier, because news of Parley P. Pratt's murder, her plural husband, had hit Salt Lake City before that, and Will even acknowledged later that he probably had made too much out of that. Another criticism in a review was that Will gave preference to later accounts that were critical of Brigham Young and or the Mormons, but discarded later accounts that were less helpful to him. And this goes to the heart of Mountain Meadows massacre history. The sources are wildly problematic. They're rarely contemporary, and they're pretty much always partisan. I'm guessing you might have picked up on this by now.
In an essay from friend of the podcast Joe Geisner's excellent book, Writing Mormon History, Will described he began to encounter obstacles in researching at the LDS Historical Department toward the end of his project. He felt that this was explained in another made-for-TV moment. At the 2002 Mormon History Association meeting, advanced copies of his Blood of the Prophets arrived just in time for a session in which church historian Rick Turley announced that he, Ron Walker, and Glenn Leonard would be writing their own accounts of the massacre.
I said, one, two, three, pass that old bottle down. It's high west when I'm dry. I'll hold me sweet, your little kisses, baby, and give me heaven when I die. It's burning hot now, wild and free, down the road to Lover's Lane. Those midnight lanterns shine, and burning oh so bright, and this may never be again.
After a massive effort of research with a huge team, Massacre at Mountain Meadows appeared in 2008. It was a concise book, clocking in at just 230 pages, not counting the appendices and the notes and all that. And not surprisingly, given this very public announcement and the vibe that this was going to be a quasi-official perspective, pre-publication hype was huge. I clearly remember going to the author event with these guys at Benchmark Books. It was just a few months before I started working there. They had to put it in a different room down the hall because a big crowd was expected, and it was indeed big. It was hot as all hell. It was August, and they ran out of books. And for anyone that knew Kurt, this was not a fun day. At the end, he mentioned they had a couple books that they were going to make available, and they would do it by a waiting list. So I zipped up to the front, got my name in there, and got a copy, and got all three of them to sign it. And it was fun, because over the coming years, I would get to know all three of them to varying degrees, which was fun.
Also, not surprisingly, there were opinions on the book. David Bigler, who would later co-edit a documentary history with Will Bagley, was, let's say, less than fully complimentary. He dismissed much of the narrative, arguing, quote, their work offers little new. Sounding much like his good friend Will, Dave complained that professed editorial freedom and access to hitherto restricted documents have mainly produced more decades-old tales of immigrant misconduct, while conspicuously absent is contemporary evidence the victims harmed any persons on property.
Newell Bringhurst was more positive, pointing to the obvious level of research that went into the book, with historical context for the massacre being especially valuable. Also, like other reviews, he enjoyed their discussion of group psychology, basically the idea of mob mentality, as a factor in the massacre. However, Newell did also see one glaring hole. In the preface, the authors outlined how they were going to answer four questions. What did the terrible atrocity say about the killers? What did it say about the church and their leaders? Did early Mormonism possess a violent strain so deep and volcanic that it erupted without warning? And what did the Mountain Meadows Massacre say about religion in general? In his review, Newell opined that the authors did no better than allude to the questions without providing solid answers to any of them. And like other reviewers, he was bummed that the book just screeches to a halt without a concluding chapter.
In their defense, this was not all they had to say. At some point, they decided it was too much to handle in one book and planned all along to publish another book covering the aftermath, cover-up, and trials. Did they? Yes. Did it take longer than they planned? Yes. Now, if anyone has ever tried to write a book, this will sound very familiar. If you haven't, trust me, there are too many rabbit holes, too many sources, too many words. Writing a whole book is just hard. Writing one about a complicated, complex topic is much harder. Ask me how I know. I mean, just so you know, the Juanita book could have been a book all about the massacre if we let it. And I think massacre historians will be disappointed that it's not, because I think that book has been written many times now, including by the author Juanita Brooks. My book is about her life and what shaped her choices in writing about the massacre. But I will say that even stepping into that landmine, into that field a little bit, is a landmine. Everybody's mad. Everybody thinks that you aren't talking about this, that, or the other enough. And it's tricky because, remember, there was an active cover-up before the massacre even began. And so they were trying to control the narrative. So you will get sources that will discount the massacre. You will get sources that will say that it was other people. That obfuscation is by design. It was baked into the massacre. So it's very tricky to write something when the people that had territorial control controlled the sources.
So, 15 years after the original, in 2023, the sequel is published. This time we have Rick Turley from the first book, and then another friend of the podcast, Barbara Jones Brown, who had been the content editor of the first book, is now the co-author with Rick. The book, Vengeance is Mine, gave a very helpful summary of the lead-up and actual massacre, and then told the story of the aftermath. Their discussion of the road to the massacre included mentioning this theme of avenging the blood of the prophets that was in the endowment ceremony from Nauvoo, and then the associated idea of blood atonement. And I would say probably the element that garnered the most attention was framing the massacre within a policy change in which Brigham Young would no longer hold back Native attackers.
And that's it?
That's it. There you go, friends. There's a roadmap of the most significant things that have been published on the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Hopefully that'll give you a sense of how the scholarship has evolved over the years. And really, we still owe a lot of our understanding of this to Juanita Brooks. If she hadn't undertaken that massive project, who knows when or if anyone would have.
What I want you to know is how much I love you. I place no one above you. You're always in my prayer. And on the day you were born, something inside of me grew, and something inside of me.
Today, more than ever, remember that you can get these books, along with everything else in the Mormon universe, at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.